Excellent. How many of you here are good at loving your enemies? Anybody? Amanda's got it down. Jim's got it down. I've got to admit to you, I am not particularly very good at that at all. It's still one of those things I'm trying to get the hang of. Still trying to get the hang of that one. But there is a whole biblical tradition about laying one's hands on people who are in need of prayer in the Bible. And what I've often thought to myself is if I were to lay my hands upon my enemies, then they would certainly need prayer. It's a joke. I wouldn't really have done that. But there are certainly times in our lives in which we do get on each other's nerves. There are times in our lives in which we irritate one another. When I think about the life that Christ had with us in his 3 years of ministry, periodically he probably became pretty frustrated with humanity. I mean, at the very beginning of his ministry, when he did his very first sermon in Nazareth, it wasn't received well. He was so excited to preach to his hometown, but a group of them eventually drove him out of his hometown, carrying him with murderous intent to a cliff to throw him over. Well, Jesus simply held them in their tracks at that point. He didn't hurt a single one of them. He just simply said, "You don't get to murder me today. Today is not my day." And he passed through them, right through their midst, and went on his way. He didn't lay a single hand on any of them, though they deserved probably a heavenly beatdown. But he didn't do that. He simply went on his way, and he separated himself out away from his hometown because he realized Nazareth and himself, they need a little cooling off time period. And so sometimes in our lives, we all need a cooling off time period. And Jesus allowed that for Nazareth because he loved the people who lived there. Now the Pharisees were their own special source of joy for Jesus. And have you ever had people that would try to interrupt everything that you ever were trying to teach? And the Pharisees would always tend to show up at any time that Jesus wanted to teach something and try to interrupt, try to undermine any kind of authority he had. Because I'm certain that the Pharisees were beyond frustrated that Jesus didn't come to them first to get their authority before he went out to teach, because they, of course, were the ones who understood the law better than anyone. They were the ones who had the authority to teach. And so they asked themselves, who is this guy, Jesus? And by what authority does he go out into the world to teach the people? Who is this guy that heals people and saves people's lives? How does he have such authority to do such things? Who's given him this authority? Certainly not us. And I can imagine Jesus over and over again in his confrontations with the Pharisees having to take a really deep breath and check his pulse and breathe in the Holy Spirit to calm his nerves. But I think all of us come to a certain point in our lives in which arguing just doesn't help anything any further. That we need a time out away from each other. That when our adrenaline is running high, when our hearts are pounding, when our mouths are dry and our throats are constricting, those are usually the times in which we are least capable of listening to one another, let alone learning from one another. And so Jesus would give that time, that space between himself and the Pharisees. And in the passage, the first passage that Kimberly read this morning, he basically said to the Pharisees, "I don't need to justify myself to you any longer. And as a matter of fact, I'm done having this conversation with you." And he went on his way. But then there also come times in our lives in which we just lose it. We see an abuse that is happening right underneath our noses and we can't walk away. Walking away just isn't an option. Jesus was out going through the temple during the week of Passover. And every good Jewish person, frankly, from across the world was required to go back to Jerusalem to pay their tithe in the temple. And there they would give their tithe, they would use their money to go buy doves or other animals to be sacrificed, asking for God's forgiveness, or praising God for the great life and the freedom that God gives to all of us. And there in the temple was a system set up for money changers. Because you couldn't just use your money in the temple had its own currency. And what the money changers were doing is they were cheating everybody who was coming in. The exchange rate was not good. The temple was profiting off of it. It was a whole system of corruption that was set up that absolutely infuriated Jesus. And when he saw it, I can imagine him saying, "Oh no, you didn't. This is my Father's house." And he saw his Father's house being turned into a den of corruption. It was too much for him to deal with. And so he grabbed a hold of the money changers' tables and he sent the money flying. And I can imagine him grabbing a hold of their robes and taking them to the entrance of the temple and tossing them out. And in the meantime, the scribes and the Pharisees, the chief priests, were watching the whole thing go down. And they were the ones who had authorized this whole system going through there. And they were furious with him for what he had just done. They were furious. And they began to immediately plot a way to get rid of Christ. And so how do you get rid of your enemies? Well, as we approach Good Friday, we know with the chief priests and the Pharisees how they got rid of Jesus. But how do you get rid of your enemies? That was a question my son Noah asked me several Wednesdays ago at Eden Eve. I think it was a riddle that he was trying to tell me. He had a big smile on his face. He said, "Dad, how do you get rid of your enemies?" Now, I've been doing martial arts since 1990, and so I went through my brain all the different creative ways in which I could get rid of my enemies. And in my devious mind, I smiled. But I realized none of those things were what Noah was talking about. And so I asked him, I was like, "Noah, how do you get rid of your enemies?" He smiled at me. He's like, "Well, Dad, it's easy. Turn them into your friends." Oh, yeah, of course, Noah. That is a much better answer than I was about to give. Turn them into your friends. But it's hard. It's really hard. It was hard for Jesus even. But I have to remember that when Christ died on the cross, he died for the money changers and the Pharisees and the scribes and the Sadducees just as much as he died for you and for me. He loved them all. But it is hard. Now, I'm happy to say that at this point in my life, I really have nobody I would consider my enemy. I have no real enemies. Now, I've got plenty of people in the world that I disagree with, but I don't consider them enemies. I don't consider them evil just because they disagree with me. Now, this doesn't say that I've not had enemies in my life. Believe me, I've had enemies. And perhaps the bad thing about me, and perhaps this is bad to say this, but I don't let them live in my mind anymore. I just don't give them that much space. I don't give them that much time in my life. And part of me says I just don't have the extra energy to give them any longer, to even care about them any further. So it's one thing to separate ourselves out from those we would consider enemies. But man, it's a whole other level of what Christ is calling us to do. It's to transform our enemies into a friend. Now, have any of you ever seen that actually happen in your own life, where an enemy was transformed into a friend? That is an amazing thing. Several years back, I was serving one of my previous churches, and when I came into that church, there was a retired minister. Whoops. It should have said Mozart in disguise, and when I made the slide, it didn't quite look like that, but just go with it, please. Okay. When I went into this previous church, there was a retired minister who had made his home in this congregation. And Peter got into the habit of calling me up and threatening me on the phone. To give you a little backstory about the church, when I came into the church, there were all sorts of utilities were shut off because we weren't paying our bills. And the phone was shut off for several months also because it took some time to get that the account back up and running. And in the meantime, I had a chance to meet the staff of the church, and I met one of the musicians. And the day that she sat down to meet me, this is what she told me. She said, "Bill, you are so lucky to work with me." I was like, "Well, that's interesting. That's good. Well, good. Please tell me more." She said, "I am a genius. I'm a genius. And basically, it's like you are so lucky. It's like you getting to work with Mozart here in this church." Well, I had never quite understood that. I'm glad she told me that, because I would have not have come to that conclusion on my own. So I decided, I was like, "Here, let me listen to how she plays her music, because obviously I'm missing something." And so on Sunday mornings, I wasn't going to complain about it, but the hymns would start off at a normal tempo, but gradually they would pick up until we got to a frantic conclusion in which we were all racing through the hymn to try to get to the end and barely could get the words out of our mouths. Other hymns, on the other hand, will be played good, driving, strong, powerful hymns like Stand Up for Jesus would be played slow and plodding. like a funeral march, like a dirge. And I know I am not a genius like this particular person was, what Mozart was, but I thought to myself, perhaps I don't understand what she's doing because I'm just not at the same level that she is. But Peter would call me up on the telephone to let me know that she's not only like Mozart, she's better than Mozart. And I better start acting like I'm lucky to be working with her. And so I told him, I listened to him, and he said, you know what, he's like, what I need you to do is that you need to hire her as also the music director, and you need to hire her as the choir director. Basically gave her 3 new jobs, and he's like, you need to triple her salary. And if you don't do that, I'm going to cause the church to rise up against you, and we will drag you from the pulpit. I mean, this is 3 years into this, or 3 months into this church. I sat there listening to that, and I thought about Peter. Like I said, Peter was a retired minister, and he was well into his 80s, and he was not of good health. And sadly, it would not be long before he would not be able to drive any longer also. And so I kind of pictured this whole thing in my mind, and I tried to picture what Peter would look like dragging me from the pulpit, let alone dragging anything anywhere. And so I listened to him. I let him vent. He had his words, and I let him know I appreciated his opinions and I appreciated his perspective, and I would take it into consideration. But then I let him know, I was like, but Peter, I want you to understand this about me and about this church, is that we don't operate by threatening one another, and that's not how we get our way. And I let him know, I was like, and I know you've got a certain perspective and certain idea about the future of our music ministry, but it just may not coincide with what the church's ideas are. He went off and he started calling me all sorts of names on the phone to the point in which I considered just hanging up the telephone. I also considered going to the finance meeting on Monday and telling him to stop paying the phone bill so that I wouldn't have to pick up the phone and hear Peter talking any longer. But I didn't. And Peter kept calling until I finally got to the point in which I'd had enough. I had enough. Now, Peter was a retired minister. And like I said, it's like the two of us, we get this stuff. We understand what the ministry is about. We should understand how this stuff works. And so I thought that I could be pretty honest with him. So I told him, Peter, I was like, Peter, it's not going to be too much longer until you die. And guess who's going to be doing your funeral? I was like, I am. I said, do you really want me to remember you this way? Well, Peter went silent on the phone. And I said a prayer of thanks to God. I was like, oh, Lord, thank you for the silence. And then I immediately said a prayer of forgiveness. I said, Lord, forgive me for the honesty that just came out of my mouth. And then I asked Peter, I was like, can I come over to your house and we can talk this over face to face? And he invited me over. As I was driving over to his house down the road, he was about 3 miles away. I still had this horrible nagging feeling in my shoulders, like I wanted to punch something. But I knew that in the better part of my mind that something couldn't be Peter. And so I drove up into his driveway, and he opened his door to me, and immediately this anger started, this pouring away from me, was flowing away from me. Walked inside of his house, and there sitting on his kitchen table, we sat down across the kitchen table, and there sitting there was a loaded revolver. And I was like, are you kidding me? This octogenarian, is this guy truly threatening me? And I looked at the situation, then I was like, or is this guy just playing the same thing that all boys like to do? Is playing show and tell. Show me all the cool stuff that he's got in his house. And as it turned out, Peter just wanted to play show and tell. And he showed me all of the military memorabilia he had from the years in which he was serving our nation. He walked me around his condo and showed me the true treasures in his life, pictures of his 2 sons that he loved dearly. And I talked about my children, and we joked around and we laughed about the struggles of raising kids in the ministry. I looked at all the pictures on Peter's wall, and they were beautiful pictures that were worthy of National Geographic from the amazing places Peter had been across the world. And I told him, I was like, Peter, I was like, who took those pictures? He's like, oh, I did. I was like, Peter, you're a beautiful photographer. And as we talked, his demands slipped away. His threats ceased. And by the time I left, we were setting up a time to go to have breakfast together at a little local diner near his house. And as I drove back to the church that day, I've got to tell you, I was absolutely amazed by the way in which God has the power to turn even our most irritating enemies into good friends. And the only thing that I've discovered that has the power to do that is Christ's love. Now, Peter ended up dying about 2 years later, and I did his service. And we celebrated his life, and I still miss the conversations that we shared together over those 2 years at that little diner. Friends, this week's about giving up that category of enemies. I need to give up that category in my life. It's just not worth it to me. And I need to trust that if those people that have become irritating in my life, God can and will transform them in powerful ways. That only the love of Jesus Christ has that power to do so. In the meantime, while we're struggling, while that power is making its way into our lives, perhaps it's important for us to have a little separation, a little cooling off time period. Sometimes it's better for us to separate for everybody's well-being for a period of time. But God's intention is not for us to separate forever. But God can and will bring all of his children home. Friends, the love of Jesus Christ has the power to transform even your greatest enemy into a friend. I've seen it happen. I believe it. I've lived it. Amen.